Les conférences du Collège de France.
I'm very happy to be here, and today I'm going to talk about the way not only syntax but in general linguistic theory and what we know about models of psycholinguistics, in what way it can help neurosurgeons in the operation room. And I'll start with what we are dealing with are brain tumors. So there are people who have tumors in their brains, and usually it depends on the type, etc. But usually, they need to be removed. And the problem is, as you can see here, the blue represents the tumor. As you can see, it's deep into the brain. So in order to resect, to remove this tumor, the neurosurgeon needs to go to open the skull and to go from some direction to reach the tumor and to take it out. So if you can see here, you can see the brain from different directions, from the side, from the maybe the back, and from the top. You can see the blue, you can see that it rests between inside the brain and between crucial tracts of neurons. And the issue is that often when this brain surgery is going on, or after the brain surgery, people have language impairments. And this is what I want to help to reduce. That's my goal. What we try to do is protect people who undergo surgery using what we know from linguistic theory and from psycholinguistic theory. So our goal is, first of all, to protect the cortical areas, the areas in the outer part, the gray matter of the brain, that many of which have roles in various linguistic functions. But not only the cortical areas are important in syntax and semantics and in lexical retrieval and lexical access, but also all these areas, like when you have a computer and you have a keyboard, and you have a screen, and you have the actual computer, you have cables sometimes connecting them. So the cables are also very important. Every engineer will know that the cables are important. So we also want to protect not only the cortical areas of language, but we also want to protect the cables that connect them. And these cables are called white matter tracts. They are called white because they look white from the outside, and because of the myelin. And these tracts connect between language areas. Now, why is it problematic? It is problematic. So just to introduce to you some of the language tracts, sorry. So you can see the Aslan tract, the arcuate fasciculus, the one that looks actually like an arch, the superior longitudinal fasciculus, the purple one, the ILF, the green one that goes ventral, that is lower, and the IFOF, that goes from the occipital lobe to the frontal lobe. Now, why is it problematic? It is problematic, first of all, because it's very difficult during surgery to identify these tracts. I'm going to show you a picture. Now, because it is a talk about neurosurgery and about awake surgery, I'm going to show you brains in surgery. It's going to be red, and it's going to be a brain, okay? So if you have a problem with it, I'll try to remember to tell you before I show you the picture. So now I'm going to show you a red picture, okay? So if you have difficulty with that, you can just maybe look elsewhere. But this is how it looks during surgery. So this is after the cortical area was removed, and we go deeper into the resecting the tumor. And this is how the white matter tract looks like. It's covered with blood. We don't see it. It's impossible to see it. So how do we identify the white matter tract? How do we make sure that we don't harm it during surgery? So it might be that the tumor is here, the white matter tract is here, and we need to stop before we hit the tract, because then we cut the cable, okay? So how do we do it? The other reason why it's difficult is usually what we do, and I should go back to show you who I'm doing this research with. Usually what we do, and I say we, it's the three neurosurgeons here in Ichilov Hospital in Tel Aviv, and the wonderful Nomi Levi-Kahana, who's my postdoc, and she's a neuropsychologist in this hospital. And what we do before surgery is we do an imaging. We do fMRI and MRI, DTI, and we know exactly for this patient, we know about the brain areas, and we know something about the function of these brain areas, and we know about the tracts. However, after the surgery begins, things shift. So once part of the brain is taken out, the cortical areas are not in the same place, and the tracts shift, and they are not in the same place. So we don't know exactly where they are. And in addition to that, there is individual difference. There are individual differences between people. So if I have a patient for whom there is a tumor close to the white matter tract, and I want to protect the white matter tract, what do I do? And what I do is awake surgery. What does it mean? And here you can see the wonderful Nomi Levi-Kahana working with me next to the patient's mouth, actually. And what we do is, after the in the beginning of the surgery, the neurosurgeon opens the skull and then wakes the patient up. So throughout the whole surgery, the patient is up. It's not painful, because there are no pain nerves inside the brain. They are awake, and they talk to us. Now, we could talk to them, but it would be more efficient to actually tap the abilities that we want to protect, that we know are related to the white matter tracts that are close to the tumor and to the cortical areas that are close to the tumor. So during surgery, we use tests to make sure that the patient is protected. How do we do it? Sorry, red alert. Red picture alert. What we do, you can see on the top, you can see the instrument that applies electrical stimulation. So the idea is we want to simulate what will happen if a certain place in the brain is removed without removing this place, this area in the brain. How do we do it? The idea is to do a very short 3-second simulation by electrical stimulation. So we have a temporary electrical stimulation to different areas of the patient's brain from where the surgeon considers to go into the area of the tumor. And then we want to know what these areas do. And we do it by running a test. It's like making a 3-second, creating a 3-second impairment. Okay, so if we touch an area that is related to moving the right hand, then for 3 seconds the patient will not be able to move his right hand. Okay, the same for language. If we stimulate for 3 seconds the area that relates to syntax, the patient will not be able to do certain syntactic processes for 3 seconds. Now, the idea is to be able to identify that there is a problem in syntax in these 3 seconds, and to say, okay, this is an area that does this and that, and then I tell the neurosurgeon, stop, this area is mine, please don't touch it, please go from somewhere else. Okay, and this is a real challenge, right? What do we do in 3 seconds to be able to identify different language abilities? So I'll show you I'll just show you how it looks with counting. So a patient is already during awake surgery with this electrical stimulation, and you will see that he counts, and after at some point he can't speak. Sorry, he counts in Hebrew. And you see that there is stimulation in different areas of the brain? Now he stops. Why did he stop? because this area is responsible for the production of the motor production of speech. Stops again, okay? And that's important. What you see is that we go back to the same area of the brain, and again, he stops. So we know that this area is responsible for some motor speech production, and this is clearly a place that we don't want to harm during surgery. We want to get to the tumor from somewhere else. Okay, so that's the general idea. Now, usually electrical stimulation in awake surgery is a common practice. For protecting motor abilities, it's a common practice. But usually in neurosurgery, in many, many operation rooms, it's only counting that is used. So the patient is counting, and when he stops counting with this stimulation, they know that this is an area of what's called speech arrest, and they don't resect this area. However, there is a bit more, and I think there are some people here that I don't need to convince in that, there is a bit more to language than counting. Okay, so it's good to identify areas that when you count, that the patient cannot continue counting in. It's very good, but it's not enough. And there are a few operation rooms throughout the world where people also ask for naming. So they show pictures of objects and the patient has to name, and during this naming there is electrical stimulation. And once the patient fails to name, they know that this is an area that is important for language. Now what I try to say is that we cannot map language. We can map different language abilities. And it will be good if we have very good tests for each kind of language ability, and then we can understand the network for this patient and understand from where it would be best to access the tumor. So, and this is where linguistic theory and psycholinguistic theory comes into play, because it will give us the tools to understand exactly what kinds of abilities we want to test. It would give us the tools into what are the clinical markers for each ability, right? And it will allow us to do assessment before surgery, after surgery, and during surgery, when the patient, in these 3 seconds that the patient fails to say some sentence, we should know exactly what the type of sentence that they fail to say is, and what exactly the type of error that they make is saying about this area. Okay? So, that's the idea. Now, the other point, there are several points here that are general points here that I want to make before I start showing you our approach to mapping patients' language areas. What can we infer? Okay, there is a patient, he's in surgery, we do this stimulation, and he fails to repeat an object relative. Does it mean that this is his area of object relatives? Does it mean that, can we infer immediately that this is an area for object relatives? And I would like to say no, because it might be that this patient has a problem due to, usually these tumors, some of these tumors may press the white matter tracts or the cortical areas and cause language impairment. So it might be that the tumor itself already caused problems with object relatives, or with naming, or with repeating non-words, right? So how can we infer in surgery, in these very, very precious sequences of 3 seconds, how can we infer that this is the area that we are looking for that is related to object relative? Maybe he failed because he has a problem in object relatives. Maybe it's not because of the tumor. Maybe he has a premorbid developmental language impairment. So what do we do? And what we do is a very broad assessment before surgery. Okay, so I get a phone call from usually from Nomi, from Nomi Kahana, saying, "Okay, we have surgery in 2 days. Come here. We need to test. We need a broad testing of language in Arabic or in Hebrew or in Russian or in," and then we start testing very, very systematically across language domains, we start testing this patient. And this is important because we need to know what is impaired and can be and cannot be tested anymore, and what is intact and should be protected. Okay. So what we do in this and this is something that usually there were only cognitive testing before surgery. And now, at least in Ichilov Hospital, we do a very, very broad, we already tested more than tested. There were already surgeries for more than 150 patients in this using this approach. And what we usually do is, after we do this very broad assessment, we identify which abilities are intact for this patient, what we can map the day after in the operation room, and we also identify abilities that are impaired, but we do it very, very carefully. So, for example, if the patient has a reading impairment, someone told me this morning, okay, if the patient already has a reading impairment, you can sacrifice their reading. So our idea is that we don't sacrifice their reading. We identify exactly what is impaired, for example, in reading. Maybe he has a problem already in reading non-words. So in surgery, we'll assess real words. Okay? Maybe he has a problem with reading long words. In surgery, I will assess short words. Okay? Maybe he has a problem in reading morphologically complex words. I'll assess morphologically simple words. So the idea is to be very careful, like linguistic theory taught us, and to identify exactly what is already impaired and what can still be protected. So this is what we do. We identify the areas that, first of all, what linguistics can help us is identify exactly which areas should be tested, right? It's not enough to say language. Maybe we want to say to test syntax, and we want to test different types of lexicons, and we want to test phonology and semantics, and maybe pragmatics. And then we know the clinical markers for each, and this is something that we might know from patients after stroke or from individuals with developmental language impairments. We know what kind of clinical markers are the best to identify each kind of impairment. And then we design tests that assess these abilities. And it's not easy because not every test can be tested with, you know, with these 3 seconds constrained. And then we find for each, as I said, for each patient, what exactly is impaired, what remained intact. We run the test before surgery, we run the test in surgery, and also, very, very important, run the test after surgery. So what we did, we now do with all our patients, that 3 months after surgery, we invite them and we test their language again. Why is it important? First of all, we want to see for each patient if there is any remaining problems. We want to send them to speech therapy, and we want them to improve their quality of language, and by this, improve their quality of life with treatment. The other reason is that once we understand that if the surgeon touches the supplementary motor area and this results in a permanent language impairment, we will, in the future, we will tell the neurosurgeon, this area do not touch this area. Try to go through another area. So it's very important also for conclusions for the future. And finally, we learn, and I'll show you some examples, how we learn as a byproduct of this work that is essentially clinical, we learn a lot about the way language is represented in the brain. So we do testing before, during, and after surgery. And as I told you, we already tested more than 150 patients with the glioma, either low-grade or GBM, glioblastoma. Okay, so now I'll start to shortly say something about the way we map what kinds of tests we use for mapping the patient's language. And then I'll start showing you some exciting results. So this is the idea. As I told you, the idea is to use a very broad battery of language tests in which we assess syntax, We assess lexical retrieval and sometimes also lexical access and comprehension, morphology, phonology, including phonological working memory, and reading. Once we identify that a patient has a problem in one of these domains, we continue. So for example, we found out that the patient has a problem in reading words, and he makes mainly letter position errors, we'll continue with designated tests to assess this kind of impairment. And we have quite a lot of tests for each condition that we continue according to this specific patient's needs. And then in surgery, we start with a baseline. What does it mean, baseline? The patient is already awake after he was woken up after the skull is open. Why is it important to have another baseline after we tested them a day before and 2 days before? Because being in this situation is not a normal situation. To lie in bed in the anxiety of surgery and after being woken up from sedation is not exactly the same as just sitting in the office of a neuropsychologist and doing tests. So we want to compare their abilities not to what they've done the day before, but to a baseline that is before the surgery starts, but without stimulations. And then we do on the cortical area, we do a mapping. We contribute to the neurosurgeon decision of regarding where to enter to access the tumor, and then the resection starts. And we continue, first of all, we are talking, so we get spontaneous speech from the patient, and then we do stimulations again, close to the white matter tracts, just to make sure that we don't touch any of the very important cables that connect the language areas. And then, as I told you, 3 months later, we also test the patient. Now it's... Okay, I actually said that. So it's important to identify what is already impaired, but not to give up the whole language ability, but to find exactly for each ability what we can still protect. But I said that before, so I skipped this. Okay, so just to give you an idea of what we are doing in this very baseline broad assessment before surgery, we, for syntax, we test comprehension, production, and repetition of sentences with movement and sentences with embedding. We test tense and agreement, so morphological, morphosyntactic abilities. We sometimes also test the syntactic lexicon, so complements of verbs. We test in picture naming. Sometimes if picture naming is very difficult, because of a problem in identifying the picture, we use naming to definition. And when the patient has a lot of problems, we also try to find out how we can monitor naming during surgery. So sometimes we use opposite tests, which is easier than picture naming. And sometimes we test how it will be possible to name, to ask them to name pictures when we give them the first syllable. So we don't give up. We don't give up language areas, we just try to find a way for each patient to be able to identify what they still have left in this domain. And we test non-word repetition, which is phonology and phonological working memory, span tasks for phonological working memory, and we test reading. And this is how we create a profile. You can see each line is a patient, each column is a different domain, and we create a profile for each patient, but a profile that we can actually draw. If this is a model, I'm not going to go into this model, but it's a model of how we process lexical items, or words, how we read words, how we understand heard words, how we produce words, how we write words, and we find for each patient exactly where in this functional cognitive model where exactly their difficulties are, and what is protected, what is intact, and then we know what to monitor during surgery, and we also know what to refrain from, what kinds of tests we don't want to give the patient, what kinds of words we don't want to give the patient during surgery. And we do the same for syntax. So we assess syntactic movement with intervention, because we know that in many languages it's a very sensitive clinical marker for language impairment. And if the patient is already impaired in this, we go towards some other abilities like embedding and the comprehension and production of pronouns. And we create this kind of algorithm. So we say, okay, we test syntax. If the comprehension and production and repetition of sentences with movement, if all of this is okay, we assess this during surgery. If they are impaired, then we look for embedded sentences or we look for pronouns. We always try to find a way to find what is still, we are very positive. We are looking at what is still intact and we can protect. And the same, we do the same with lexical processes, what we can still protect. We do the same with phonological working memory and with reading. So we look, we give tests of reading of words and non-words and word pairs. If it's okay, we give reading in surgery. It's a very useful task. If there is a problem, we take out the types of words that are difficult for the patient, and we use only types of words that we know according to their deficit that are going to be okay in surgery and can be assessed. So that's the general idea. The details are less important here, but this is the general approach. Now, when we talk about this approach, I just want to stress why it's different from what has been done so far, because even in operation rooms where naming is tested, usually what people do is, okay, before surgery he failed in naming a table, scissors, and wall, so we take out these words from the test. But I would like to suggest that in neuropsychology in general, in neuropsychological impairments in general, it's not the actual item on which a person makes an error is not consistent. What is consistent is the types of errors. What is consistent is the type of impairment. So if a patient, for example, has a problem of letter position encoding, they might, in pre-test, they might read slime as smile, but in surgery, they might read trail as trial. So it's not enough for me to take out the items that they failed on. I want to understand exactly why they failed on these items, make the generalization, and take out the items that are relevant for the deficit and keep only items that should not be impaired. Okay? And that's the general idea. Not take out items, take out types of items that are relevant to the type of impairment. And by doing this, we are ready for the surgery. Now, another thing that is really important for us is, in Israel, there are many, many bilinguals, but also in a lot of your countries, there are many bilinguals. So we want to test them in the language that is most important for them and the language that they master best. Okay. So if I have a patient who came to Israel from Russia when she was 52, okay, and now she's 60, I would like to test her in Russian and not in Hebrew, even if she speaks some Hebrew. Okay. So it will be less comfortable for me, but it will be best for protecting her language abilities. Okay. So this is why we made a lot of effort to make the whole broad battery ready, not only in Hebrew, but also in Palestinian Arabic and the written parts in Standard Arabic and in Russian. These are three languages that are spoken a lot in Israel and also in Israeli Sign Language. And we also have at least parts of the tests in many other languages. And we strive to, every time we have a patient who comes from another language, we recruit friends from around the world to help us create the test for this patient, so we will be able to protect their abilities in their languages. Not an easy task, we don't always succeed, but we really try hard that they will be tested in their language. And I think this is also important to discuss with the patient. So we want to discuss with the patient and ask, what is important for you? What language is the language that is important for you, for your everyday life? What is the language that you feel that you know, that you master best, right? No, we don't decide, they decide. It takes more time, but it's worth it. Okay. And now I'm going to start by showing you some results, some ways in which we identify areas in the brain that are in charge of various things, some results that from this approach that I told you about. And I'm going to start with telling you about various impairments in reading, and then I'm going to talk about syntax and sentence building. So when we talk about reading, and specifically about impairments in reading, when we talk about the process of reading, it's a process that starts, and I'm talking about reading single words and single non-words. We start with a sequence, a written word, and then we get to understanding it and to saying it out loud. So it's a process that has several stages. So for example, when we read a written word that we know, we have to identify which letters are there, what is their order. We have to get to some kind of a list, a lexicon of written words, and from there to a list of the way that the words sound like, and then to hold this, all these phonemes and say them out loud. We want to understand the written word, and we also want to be able to read new words, right? Because if we get to a city we don't know, and we want to read the names of the streets, some of these words will not be in our lexicons, and we need to be able to read in a letter to a sound conversion. So this is in general the process of reading aloud. And the most important thing for us now is that there are various stages, and each of these stages can be selectively impaired due to a tumor or due to resection of a tumor, and create a different type of dyslexia. And we currently know of 23 different types of dyslexia. Okay? And we need to know all of them, and we need to know exactly what kinds of words are difficult for each kind of dyslexia in order to be able to protect the reading of our patient. So the question is, how is this reading model implemented in the brain? And specifically, we are asking about what exactly do these white matter tracts do in the dyslexia, in the process of reading. And what I'm going to show you are data from three approaches. One of them is looking at the tumors. So as I told you, some patients already come when the tumors already press their white matter tracts. And we want to see, for patients who show exactly the same kind of reading impairment, we want to see where their tumor is and to see where is the parallel area that is impaired in all of them. And this will give us information about where this process is in the brain. This is one way to look at this question. Another way to look at this question is by looking during stimulation to see when I stimulate the arcuate fasciculus, what happens? When I stimulate the ILF, what happens? When I stimulate the aslant tract, what happens? And understand from there what these white matter tracts do. Another approach, I didn't write it here because it belongs to the second part of the talk, is to look at their post-op and see when the certain areas were resected and they do have some kind of disability, to look at the areas that were impaired and to learn from them and from the function that is impaired, what is the relation between function and brain tissue. Okay, so in order to do all this, each patient read a long list of 136 words, 40 non-words, and 60 words presented in pairs. And this is a screening task. And this screening task is built so that it will be sensitive to all 23 kinds of dyslexia that we currently know. So it includes types of words that are sensitive to the different kinds of dyslexia. And then, according to the errors and the types of words that are difficult to each patient, we identify what the deficit is. So I'm going to start with presenting to you what the approach is to protect a language, I'm going to start with letter position dyslexia. Letter position dyslexia, not surprisingly, is a problem in letter position encoding. So what does it do? It causes people to read bread as beard, for example, or in Italian, torta as trota as torta. What is important in this dyslexia, is that errors happen especially when they create another word. Right? So table, they will not make errors in the word table because you cannot, talb is not a word, right? But in the word slime, when you make errors in the order of the middle letters, you create another existing word, this is susceptible to errors. So, and what we find is that really words like from, that when you make letter position errors, it creates another existing word, right? Form. They are susceptible to letter position errors much, much more than words like frog. Because words like frog, if you change the order of the letters, you don't get an existing word. So we created lists of migratable words in many languages, including French, by the way, in a beautiful work with Stanislas Dehaene, and later also with Cassandre Poitier. In our list of migratable words, or words that if you change the order of the letters, you create another existing word in Russian, we identified a patient. So this patient came to the hospital with, you can see, quite a large tumor. And he complained that it's difficult. He loves to read, and now it's difficult for him to read. And we gave him the reading test, and luckily in our reading test, as I told you, we build it in a way that will be sensitive to the different kinds of dyslexia. And what we saw are these errors. So even if you can't read Russian, I think maybe just by comparing the target word and how he read the word, he read Bodro as Bordo, Sharm as Shram, Mrak as Mark, Irka is Ikra, okay? Exactly. He makes letter position errors. So what do? We already know before surgery that this patient has good reading except for letter transposition errors. So do we sacrifice his reading in the day after in surgery? No. What we do is simply make sure that we don't present migratable words. We just present words that are not susceptible to his letter position dyslexia. And then we are able to map his reading and protect his reading. And this is work with Yulia Resnik. Now, just one small thing. Maybe you were thinking about this yourself. Okay, so if the tumor is in this area, maybe we can deduce where the letter position dyslexia is. So I thought so too, but we make sure to take very detailed anamnesia from every patient. And it turns out that this patient, his brother and his daughter also have reading problems. And we actually tested them later, not the daughter, but the brother, and they have letter position dyslexia. So it seems that actually his letter position dyslexia might be developmental. So we don't, in these cases, we cannot deduce that this is the area of letter position encoding, okay? We need to be careful. So this is just one thing that we learned to add. Ask the patient whether they had problems in reading or any problems, any learning disabilities in school, any difficulties in school. Okay, ask about family members who might have language difficulties, reading difficulties, writing difficulties, in order not to make this incorrect to draw an incorrect conclusion in this case. Okay, so this is just the approach of understanding what a patient has and presenting the right stimuli during surgery. Now I'm going to move to a different type of dyslexia. It's called attentional dyslexia, and it's called attentional dyslexia because it has nothing to do with attention. But in 1977, when Challis and Warrington discovered this kind of dyslexia, they thought it has, and the name remained. What happens in this dyslexia, I'll show you the I'll show you an example from French. Okay, so this is a pair of words that we presented to a seventh grader, not with a tumor, just as an example of this dyslexia. And on the right, you can see how he read the two words. So instead of, I will not even try to pronounce it. I'll try to pronounce it and you can laugh at me. So instead of grave, he said brave. Where did this B come from? You have any idea? Okay, let's try another one. Instead of, let's look at the last one. This became let or le. Where did this L come from? Do you see any L in the area? Okay. Now look at all the errors that he makes, and you can see that all the errors, he doesn't just substitute letters. What happens to him is that letters jump between words. And the first letter remains the first letter, just not in the right word. And the last letter remains the last letter, just not in the right word. Okay, do you see that? You see that it can jump from one, the first word to the second, from the second to the first, from above, from below. This is attentional dyslexia. Migrations of letters between words. Now, this dyslexia will never be identified if we only show single words, because it's migrations of letters between words. So that's another thing that we need to know. We need to show word pairs and not only single words. So we have migrations from the first to the second, from the second to the first. And again, when we look at this dyslexia, we know from work on attentional dyslexia that errors occur mainly or almost only when the migration between words creates another existing word. So what we need to do is present word pairs that are migratable. So migration between the words would create another existing word. And then we can identify this kind of dyslexia. Now the question is, where is it in the brain? How do we identify this dyslexia in the brain? And until now it wasn't identified in the brain. So again, we use these two approaches. One approach is to look at patients who have attentional dyslexia, pure attentional dyslexia, and see where their tumor in the brain is. And the other is to look at stimulations, areas of stimulation, and to see at least what kind of white matter tract is sensitive to these kind of errors. So let's start with four patients who had attentional dyslexia following tumor. And you can see in blue the tumor, and what you can see in orange is the white matter tract called IFOF that connects the occipital lobe and the frontal lobe. Okay, it goes like that from the back of the brain to the frontal part of the brain. And even if you are not a neuroradiologist, can you see that the tumor sits somewhere very similar on the IFOF? You see that the IFOF has this kind of fan in the back, and it sits somewhere here in the back part of the IFOF. So there is a shared place, a place that is shared by all four patients who show attentional dyslexia. So we have a good first, this is the IFOF, the lovely green thing here. So we have a good first approximation to the position of the function that connects letters to the words in which they appear. Okay, so this is one approach, looking at, indeed, it's not huge number of patients, but it's very consistent. The position of the tumor is very consistent. Now I'm going to go to mapping attentional dyslexia during surgery. So inducing migrations between words using this stimulation on the white matter tract. And I'm going to tell you about Libby, a lovely person with tumor. She's a quadrilingual, so she spoke French and German and English and Hebrew. And we tested her. We asked her which language is important to you, and she said all of them. So we tested her in her four languages. And what we saw was that when we presented the word pairs, and we already suspected, right, because we already saw four patients before who had tumors quite close to where she was impaired. So we tested her, for example, in French. I can show you, this is a few moments after she arrived in the department, I was still at home, so you can see my living room, and I was with her on Zoom. And this is the list of words that she read. But she made only a single error of migration between words. People with typical language sometimes make errors. So this doesn't mean that she has dyslexia, but it meant to me that I have to be careful with this kind of dyslexia, and I have to make sure that in surgery we don't it means that we might be close to this area of migration between words. What happened in her English, you can see again, she was quite normal. She had one, maybe two migrations between words within the normal range. In Hebrew, again, two migrations between words within the normal range. And then we had to have German, and we didn't have migratable word pairs in German. So immediately I called Saskia Konen from Australia and said, Saskia, we need today a list of migratable words. And Saskia is very sporty. She came up with this list of migratable words. We gave them to Libby, and she read them correctly. And the next day, surgery. What do we do during surgery? We want to make sure that she doesn't start making these kind of errors. So we present word pairs. She was very, very good with the word pairs all through the surgery. And then we got, remember this IFOF and this back part of the IFOF? We got close to this back part of the IFOF. And we made sure we do stimulation on this area to see what happens when we stimulate this area, and she reads word pairs. So I'm going to show you Libby reading word pairs in surgery. And this yellow bolt means that at this moment she was stimulated on the IFOF. You see how consistent the pattern of errors is when this area is stimulated? She makes letter substitutions, but it's not just letter substitution that come from nowhere. It's always a letter that appears in the same position in a neighboring word. Let's look for a second. Waves become waved because there is a D in the previous word. And dine become fine because there is an F in the beginning of the next word. And over becomes oven because there is an N in the end of the previous word. And why does groom become froom? Can you see it? Where is the F? Above. There is F in five. Okay, so it can come also from above and from below. So we can see that it's very, very clear. Stimulation creates migrations between words in this point. And when there is no stimulation, she doesn't make any errors, and the same, she read the same lists several times, and she made no errors. Just when she was stimulated, she made an error. And because we knew that there is attentional dyslexia, and because we knew about the general area of letter-to-word binding, and we had this ability to stimulate and to show word pairs, we were able to protect her and save her from not being able to read, and she really, really likes to read. So it's really important, in this case, it's important to show word pairs, because if we only showed single words, we would miss this whole thing completely. So again, theory of psycholinguistic theory and knowing the properties of different types of dyslexia, in this case, helped save the reading of this patient. Okay. Now moving to a different kind of dyslexia, surface dyslexia, a more famous kind of dyslexia. And surface dyslexia is a dyslexia that affects the lexical root for reading. So instead of, if there is a problem in the lexical root for reading, we have to read every word as if it were a new word. So if we read the word walk, for example, and we read it as if it's a new word, we will read it as walk, right? Or walk. And if we read the word stomach as if it were a new word, we'll read it as stomach, right? And if we read door as if it were a new word, we might read it as dur, right? So these are irregular words in English. And when someone has surface dyslexia, these are the kinds of word errors that they make. So first of all, we have to present irregular words in order to identify this kind of dyslexia. And then if we want to know which white matter tracts are in charge of the lexical route, what we can do is see which patients show, where are the tumors of the patients who show this kind of regularizations, who show this kind of reading of words as if they were new words. And what we find is a very clear correlation between mean diffusivity, so it's a measure of the white matter tract, and surface errors, so errors like walk and stomach in the ILF, in the white matter, this green white matter tract. Okay? So we might have identified the lexical root in the cables, that connect cortical areas in the brain. Now we did the same thing for the other root. So we try to understand what exactly does the arcuate fasciculus, this is the arcuate fasciculus, remember it looks like an arch. So what does the arcuate fasciculus do in reading, if it has a role at all? And again, the way we did it was looking at patients who have deficits or tumors on the AF. Patients who do not have tumors on the AF, we measured the, for each patient, we took a measure of whether their tumor is on the AF or the edema around the tumor is on the AF, or whether the tumor didn't touch the AF in any way. And we looked at errors in naming, and I'm already saying that what we found is that the AF is in charge of the sublexical root. So what does the sublexical root do? It is in charge of reading new words. So it's in charge of reading a word by converting letters to sounds. Okay. So if someone has a problem in this sublexical root, they will have problems in reading new words and non-words. And when we look at the patients who have tumors in the AF compared to patients who don't have tumors in the AF, we see that most of the patients who have tumors in the AF show problems in reading non-words, new words, and patients who have no tumor in the AF don't have problems in reading non-words. So we may have found the root for the sublexical root in the AF. So now we have a picture where we might have found the lexical root and we might have found the sublexical root, and I want to show you something interesting about the interaction between these two roots. Actually, two types of interactions between these two roots. Okay, so we talked about the lexical root, that when it is impaired, you have to read each word as if it were a new word. And I show you the sublexical root that affects reading new words. And this is NL, a patient, he was a pilot and a high school teacher, and he had a tumor, a glioblastoma, sadly, and we tested his reading before surgery, and this is the type of the errors that he made. The fact that you don't know these words is because these are non-words. They don't exist in Hebrew. I think they don't exist in many other languages. So he read shigazon, which is a non-word in Hebrew, as shigazol, and magrisha as markiza, and ksina as ksida, and mitlachot as mitlashot, and ziflonet as zivlonet, and madralot as matralot. So a lot of voicing errors, but not only voicing errors. So what you can see is that he makes consonant errors in reading non-words. He didn't have any problems in words. So we identified the position, the area of his, the functional deficit that he has in the sublexical root. Now, what do we do in surgery? We don't need to sacrifice his reading, right? What we need to do is present words that will be fine. We present existing words. So in surgery, we only tested existing words because we knew already that he has, that his tumor causes a problem in reading consonants of non-words. So during surgery, we assessed his reading, and then you see the green tract. There is a little star on the green tract. Maybe I can show you this. This is the green tract. It's the ILF. Remember the ILF? The lexical root ILF. And we stimulated here. And what happened once we stimulated this, that he started making surface errors, starting reading Wolk and Stomach and Dur, or the parallels of this in Hebrew. But what is very important is not only during this ILF stimulation, not only did he start making errors like Stomach and Dur, he also started making consonant errors in real words. Why did he make, until now he only made consonant errors in non-words. So why did he make consonant errors in real words? Because when we stimulated, he already had consonant errors in non-words. Then we stimulated the ILF and we blocked his lexical root. So we had to read existing words via the sublexical root. In the sublexical root, he has consonant problems. So there is an interaction between his, now, once we stimulated his lexical root, we forced him to read via the sublexical root and make consonant errors also in existing words. Okay, so here we see a kind of interaction between the deficit that he had because of the tumor pressing the IFOF and the AF, and the stimulation on the ILF. And this is why I think if we really identify the lexical root and the sublexical root in the brain, we can actually turn around the model and put the brain on the model, right? And then we have the lexical root and we have the sublexical root on the model. And now I want to say something, from time to time I want to say something that will make you happier. So we were able to protect his reading, and now we tested him almost 3 months, 2.5 months after his surgery, and he was reading perfectly. So he had no problems in reading words, and he had no problems in reading non-words. He had no problems in reading non-words because the tumor is gone. And he had no problems in reading words because we protected his ILF, because we were able to stimulate and identify where it is. So this really helps people. Okay, I'm going to skip the dyslexia, even though it's a nice dyslexia, and go to syntax. Okay, so until now we talked about dyslexias and the way we can learn about reading in the brain from surgery, and now I move to talk a little bit about syntax and how we assess syntax in surgery and what we learn about syntax in the brain from surgery. And as I told you before, what we do is mainly, because we know movement and movement of the object across the subject is a very good clinical marker for syntactic impairments, we test comprehension, production, and repetition of sentences with syntactic movement, like the boy that the monkey, this is the boy that the monkey hugged. And I will not go into details of the actual tests, but I'll tell you that we test comprehension and we test a production using a preference task, which is a very, very good task in surgery because the sentence takes less than 3 seconds and we can really identify with stimulation if the patient is able to produce, for example, an object relative or not. And we do a repetition task of various kinds of sentences. Again, very useful. It works very, very well in surgery because it matches very well this limit of 3 seconds. Okay, so using all these tasks, we were able to identify the 28 of, actually now it's more, but 28 of our patients have this kind of syntactic deficit in movement. What do? We give up on the syntax? No. Once we see that there is a problem in movement, we go to assess other things that might be still preserved in their ability to build sentences. So we usually test embedding, so the ability to embed one sentence in the other, and pronouns. So this is one way we do it in surgery, and it works like a dream, and it's called the dream test, but not because it works like a dream, just because we tell the patient, okay, you see, if it's someone who's sleeping and you see this blue bubble, it's dream. And if you see a square yellow bubble, it's say, okay? So now if you, and we train them on say and dream, and then they have to explain what they see. For example, in the first picture, it's the boy said that the monkey hugs him. And in the second, the girl dreamt that the cow licked her. Okay? And this is how we made them produce an embedded sentence with a pronoun. And we see, and it work also works very well in surgery. Patients who have a very who have a cognitive impairment, it doesn't work with them, but with the others it works really well. And it's also an action naming task. And what do we find with this? Okay, so now I just told you about the test, and I'll show you what we find. So we know from fMRI, from a lot of studies on fMRI, that there are certain areas that are very sensitive to to movement, to syntactic movement. Among them, the IFG, what you see here in pink, and this STG, and the angular gyrus. When we look at patients who have tumors that cover Broca's area, the IFG, I'll show you what you see here. This is a patient with a huge tumor. The yellow is the tumor, okay? Very, very large tumor, and 0% correct in the syntactic tasks. This is a patient with beige. You see the tumor, 14% correct, only 14% correct in the syntactic tasks. And this is the patient with the tumor in yellow with 60% performance. You see, these three patients have tumors that affect the language areas. What happens after we remove their tumor? Here, the tumor was not removed completely, but it was. It doesn't affect anymore the Broca's area. 100% in the syntactic tasks. Here, 100% in the syntactic tasks, and here, 90% in the syntactic tasks. So what you can see is that when the tumor is removed from language areas, the language abilities may recover. Even complex language abilities like syntactic movement with intervention. Now I want to show you a bit how important it is to know syntax in order to assess language during surgery. And I'm going to start with a 32-year-old. We have a lot of young people with tumors. And this is a 32-year-old person with quite a large tumor. And you can, and I want you to see the way we stimulated, what happens when we stimulated his brain in frontal and temporal areas and asked him to repeat sentences with and without movement. And a red alert. This is the cow that the rabbit met. This is the rabbit that the cow met. Okay? Reversal. This is the teacher that the student saw. Reversal. Simple sentence. No problem. Okay, now stimulation in a different area. No problem, even though it has movement. Okay, now I'll tell you what you saw. So first of all, we see stimulations in an area that has to do with movement. Probably this IFG area, the Broca's area. And what you see is that we say a sentence with movement, and he repeats it with the roles reversed. So instead of this is the cow that the rabbit met, he says this is the rabbit that the cow met. Instead of saying this is the teacher that the student saw, he says this is the student that the teacher saw. But when we say a simple sentence, no problem. Yesterday the juice spilled on the floor, no problem. Okay? So it's not that all the understanding sentences is gone, or repetition is gone, or there's a problem in memory. No, it's a problem in sentences with movement. And then we tested the same kind of sentences in a different area that is not responsible, a bit more anterior, a bit more frontal, that is not responsible for syntax. No problem. Then we went to the temporal lobe. Okay, so this is the frontal lobe and this is the temporal lobe. We stimulated the temporal lobe, and we see a different kind of error. So we present again an object relative, but what we see here are lexical errors, and he forgets the end of the sentence. Okay, so this tells us not only that there is a problem in this, that this area is important for language, it even tells us what exactly this area does. Okay, and then again, we can help the patient by protecting his language areas. And when we do that and we stimulate different areas, we can actually identify for each patient which areas are responsible for naming and which areas are responsible for syntax and which areas are responsible for the motor part of the speech. And this is a patient who was completely, whose syntax was completely okay, a young woman who's a student, and her language was completely fine even though she had a tumor in areas that are close to areas of the language. And then we assessed her language and we saw areas that are responsible for syntactic movement, a WH movement. I think you can see it here. I will skip the video. And other areas that are responsible for phonological working memory, sorry, including V2C movement and function words, morphology, and phonological errors in naming. So once we understand, if we don't know the linguistic theory and the psycholinguistic issues, we don't know why morphology would appear together with function words and with V2C movement. But if we think about the PF and about phonological, the connection between phonological and morphological abilities, then we might be able to understand why the same area causes these different kinds of errors. I'm going to finish with the embedding in surgery. And this is S, a very, very intelligent person who came to us. You can see in blue, a huge, huge tumor. In the beginning, he was completely unable to speak, nothing. And then because he had a lot of edema and he received steroids, and then he became much better. And we assessed him in surgery. And when I said, I moved the car that disturbed the traffic, he repeated, I moved the, and stopped. Now, at this point, we don't know what the problem is, right? We don't know what this area does. We don't know if it's a problem in relative clauses, in general, in A-bar movement, whether it's a problem in embedding. So what I have to do when I see this in surgery is that I immediately have to think about another sentence that will help me understand what the deficit is. I can give him A-bar movement without intervention. I can give him a sentence with embedding without movement. But I have to think on my feet to know exactly what to give him in this moment. So the sentence that came up with is, I will tell my sister that Danny is a soldier. And he said, I will tell my sister whatever, something. Okay, so he couldn't repeat it. And then I said, the president said that the minister resigned, and he said, the president said that, and got stuck. What does it tell us? It tells us that the deficit in this area is related to embedding and not to A-bar movement, or embedding, or maybe to the left periphery, but not to the movement and intervention. And then we continued and we assessed his embedding during surgery, and this is, I think, the last video that I'm going to show you. Maybe I will not show a video, I'll just tell you what you see. So I tell him, the woman said that she bought an apartment, and he says, the woman said, and he has stimulation in the STG, in the upper part of the temporal lobe, and he says, the woman said, and got stuck. Okay, and then we assess him in a different place, no problem, in the MTG. And then the singer saw that the girl danced, he has to repeat it. And he says, and he shouts at us, you don't have to shout. I can understand I can't understand anything when you shout. So he doesn't understand why he stopped understanding us. So he thinks it's because we are shouting, but actually it's because we are stimulating the STG. And then I say, the singer saw that the girls danced, and he says, the singer saw that there, and he gets stuck. So we identified his area of his area of embedding. And then after surgery, because I was worried, because I saw that we were really, really close to the area of embedding, and with this I'll finish, I went to the recovery room that is adjacent to the operation room. It was half an hour after surgery, when he woke up already. And I asked him how he was, and he said, During surgery, we were discussing hi-fi systems, and he recommended certain hi-fi systems that I thought would give me the best properties for hearing classical music. And then after surgery, I asked him how he was, and he said, not so good. And I said, oh no, he doesn't have syntax. And then I asked why, what is not so good? And he says, I think that I made a mistake in the recommendation that I made. So he said it with an embedded sentence, and afterwards we assessed his syntax, and he had wonderful syntax. He said he produced a lot of embedded sentences without any problem, so we were able to protect his embedding, and in general we were able to protect his syntax. So I will finish here by saying that I think once we give a very detailed assessment that is based on linguistic theory and psycholinguistic theory, we are able to improve the assessment of patients, and we are able to protect the language better. And we also, as a byproduct, learn quite a lot about the relation between different language functions and their areas in the brain. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.